You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Ancient tools and burials, plants and seeds, Neanderthals.
Welcome to the Archaeological Fantasies Podcast, episode 91. On today's show, Sarah, Jeb, and Ken talk about immigration and contact archaeology. Get ready to think critically.
But we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do dinosaurs.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Archaeological Fantasies Podcast. I am your host, Sarah, and I am joined today by my co-hosts, Ken Fader and Jeb Card. How's it going, guys?
Doing fine.
Interesting. It's a strange world, Sarah. And my semester is about to start again on Thursday. Jeb, are you back in classes yet?
That's becoming in the 21st century an increasingly complicated answer to give. I'm teaching online. I have been for 2 weeks or under 2 weeks.
Okay.
And I just was finishing up the Index for Spooky Archaeology and doing another thing and another thing and another thing. So yes? Question mark?
Okay. All right.
My classes start tomorrow because today was Martin Luther King Day. Otherwise, it would have started today.
Right.
So I guess we're all back in the swing of it then. All right.
But they're talking about another big snowstorm here in New England, up 10 inches, 12 inches of snow.
Oh, good
Tuesday
God.
Night through Wednesday, which could mean that Thursday is a wash anyhow, and they're all going to be plowing out. So who knows? Maybe we won't start the semester until April.
That is the one downside to online classes is, like, you don't really get breaks or holidays because, like, it's online. You know, it's like you have all week to do this anyway.
So it puts them on the same footing as grad students and post-grad students. So, you know what? Fine.
Well, if there's like a volcanic eruption or an earthquake and the internet goes down, you can't have those classes. Yeah.
I'm sure they'll still be like, why didn't you turn your paper in? But, you know, things happen. Shit happens. So, speaking of shit and things that happen, we have an interesting topic that we're going to get to today. And it's something that we have talked about in the past. But personally, I don't think we can ever talk about it enough because it's just one of those things that keeps coming up and I don't think people really understand it.
Here's the thing. Last week, the leader of the free world, decided to allegedly by any number of people.
Do we have to call him that? Do we
I'm
have
sorry
to?
That, that's your reality. No, but that's your reality.
No.
He decided, well, see, that's kind of the problem. He decided to allegedly, according to any number of journalists, as well as some people in the room, although he denies it, to call a number of countries shitholes. Something caught my eye that one of them is the one that I have dedicated most of my professional life to working in and studying, El Salvador. And that is probably because it has been in the news because of the administration's decision to cancel the TPP, which allows 200,000 El Salvadorans who left El Salvador in the wake of devastating earthquakes some 16 years ago now, to have temporary but has been extended numerous times residency in the United States if they basically keep their nose clean, they check in, they basically pay for extensions and so on. And so these are people, you know, the majority of whom are very well employed and a whole bunch own homes and all these other things. And it has been long suggested that sending these people back to a country that does have economic problems, which we might talk about why one factor that might be, tying it into some archaeology and some other issues, would be one, devastating for El Salvador, and two, you're literally taking people that have made lives and ripping them out of that. But that seems to be the order of the day these days. So I thought that I've talked a little bit about my work in El Salvador various ways on this show. We did one of the 365s, or two of them were about a little my work. And I've brought it up in the hieroglyphs one, the Maya hieroglyphs and the other hieroglyphs. I did talk about the bottle stuff a bit. But I thought it might be interesting, and I've referenced this a little, to kind of meld some discussion of El Salvador, and I'll be probably dropping some, you know, experiences and my work with excellent Salvadoran archaeologists, scientists, government officials, and so on. But my work on Ciudad Vieja, which is the first Spanish settlement in what's now El Salvador, because a lot of the things that we do talk about on archaeological fantasies involving, well, hyperdiffusion. We did a show on hyperdiffusion, and I brought up some of these issues there. But I thought it'd be interesting to sort of revisit it in a somewhat more concentrated sense, and then tie this also into issues of colonialism and the transformation into the modern world. And Ken also would like to talk about how some of this ties into issues of immigration and how archaeology, again, sort of historical archaeology. For our audience, if you're not aware, you might think everything archaeological is historical. Historical doesn't mean old, and it doesn't necessarily mean just things in the past. Historical archaeology, as it is practiced in the Americas, refers to basically the archaeology after 1492.
Right.
Not entirely, but the archaeology of the Columbian era up to the present, including industrial archaeology, which also very much means that historical archaeology kind of has to be tied to colonialism because the two are inextricable.
Right.
Well, let's spend a minute here in the first section describing what we mean when we're talking about colonialism, just for our listeners who may not be completely aware of how we use that concept in archaeology. It is tied to the concept.
Right. In terms of historical archaeology here in New England, it's pretty simple. We've got indigenous people living in what are today the New England states. And in the 17th century, people from somewhere else show up and begin settling and begin putting fences around plots of land and saying, we own this now. You guys keep out. And so very clearly there's no it's not a complicated issue. People come in and they are colonists. They call themselves colonists.
And that's settler colonialism, where it's sort of like on the, you know, individual families who are like, we are now going to live here.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
That, and so in when we talk about colonialism, we sometimes talk about what's called settler colonialism, which is that model.
Right. But there's also the greater concept of colonialism in archaeology, where it's the way I understand it, it's the who owns archaeology, who owns history kind of concept. Jeb, did you want to?
Well, I mean, I was going to maybe get to that, but what I was also going to talk about is how that is often settler colonialism. It's not exclusively the Anglosphere. It's not exclusively the British colonies and related things.
Right,
you do have it elsewhere, but another kind that is different in a lot of ways is a sort of more extraction colonialism, where you have, you know, empires coming in, bringing in small numbers of officials, but not the sort of North American model of, and or the Australian model of, and now we're going to have a vast migration of people. But, you know, for example, Spanish colonial Mexico or Peru or the Caribbean, where you have a handful of people that are going, or this is very similar actually to India and the British in the 19th and 20th century, where you have a handful of officials who are going to come in and they run into huge populations and they're going to quote unquote civilize, aka destroy the cultures there and try to make them into something like themselves and extract as many resources back to a home imperial core as possible. Those are both parts of a larger discussion of colonialism. And I think some people sometimes don't think one or the other of those falls into colonialism. Like, I think a lot of people, they look at sort of the North American and they're like, well, some of that's colonial and the British are thrown out. It's like, no. It's all part of a larger and frankly ongoing, because one of the things we've learned, and this gets back to some of the issues that sort of brought all this up, is inequalities today, that exist in, you know, for example, Guatemala or Bolivia or United States, often have their roots in colonialism and in continuing colonial structures that have not been, by any stretch of the matter, entirely dismantled.
I mean, you can look at archaeology, especially in the 19th century, as inherently colonial, where you've got European scholars going to other countries, digging the shit out of those places and bringing everything home with them.
Is that where you were going, Sarah?
Yes. So it didn't get there, but I was going there.
But you were also talking about it sort of in the modern sense, not just like in like, you know, pith helmets and so on, but in more modern senses.
Yes, there is a concept. It does carry over into even today, the whole concept of like just white researchers looking at ethnic groups and then coming to conclusions thereof. Or it can even extend into the concept of an able-bodied person examining non-able-bodied people groups and then drawing conclusions based on their own experiences. It's tied into the concept of bias. And we as researchers are very aware of what bias is and how we should try to avoid it when we are researching. So it's a concept we deal with and that we're aware of. And I just wanted our listeners to know that it's a big idea that gets tied up into a little word like colonialism. You have these ideas that are attached to it. Settler colonialism is what most people think about when they hear the word. But I didn't know if people were also aware that it also means like when we went over to other countries, when we were sending researchers to other countries to study their stuff and bring it back, or just in general, just bring their stuff back. That is also a form of colonialism.
Well, I think one of the things that I'm sure some of our listeners, because I know some of our listeners are professionals in the field, but a lot of our listeners
that
might not,
true.
Or in just in generally in academia, because it's not just archaeology, a lot of our listeners may or may not be aware, like you start reading academic literature on anything involving the past and the present, involving people and, you know, especially the last 500 years, but including to the present. And you're going to see colonialism constantly. Like it's this thing that I think a lot of people maybe don't, you know, they're like, oh, yeah, like you said, a little word, but whereas you open up anything on the archaeology of blank, colonialism is going to be front and center, because even if you're talking about something that's not related to a Spanish colony, for example, as you said, one, how archaeology is done is almost certainly going to, at least to some degree, flow along structures that have been made in the last 500 years. And two, even if you're not talking about that, you're understanding the world through a lens that's been made in the last 500 years. Like it is not an escapable matter.
Right. It's our interpretations of sites are through that same lens. Our interpretations of culture histories through that same lens.
Yeah.
Right. It's something that's very ingrained into the practice as a whole and the field as a whole.
Right.
Yeah. And I think where that kind of ties into some of what we're talking about here is you cannot understand. I mean, you know, we're all archaeologists. Of course, we're going to say you can't understand the present without understanding the past. Well, duh. Of course, we're going to think that. But you really can't understand in an even almost day-to-day basis in some senses the world around you without sort of looking at what is often called sort of the modern world. And that gets in, there are a couple different uses of the word modern. You know, some people use the word modernity to refer to basically the last 200 years. But in archaeology, when you hear people talk about the modern, at least in the Americas, and I don't just mean like the on American like historical archaeology, I mean just in our practice, they're generally talking about the last 500 or 600 years. Basically since about 1400, when you began to have significant European attempts at colonization and colonial networks, and also having, because of new naval trade routes and so on, people in much more contact than they had been to some degree prior to that time. So even before 1492, when you've got the Portuguese setting up shop in West Africa and in Goa and going around Africa, and all of a sudden you start to have information, goods, people going from Central and Eastern South Asia to Africa and to the West and vice versa, you're already starting to see this emerge. And by 1550, the world looks in many ways more like it might now than it would have several hundred years earlier than that. There's other things tied into it. But I say all this because the thing that was not the thing that brought me to El Salvador, I had actually previously worked on classic Maya things there, but my own dissertation work basically looked at the origins of that world. I started my work on sort of pre-Hispanic Mesoamerican work, but I ended up doing a dissertation on the one of the very first Spanish colonial sites, period, anywhere. Ciudad Vieja, San Salvador, historically documented to be occupied in either 1525 or 1528, and that gets into sort of how the town was founded and whether we're looking at both first versions of the town in the same place. It was abandoned after a year and then reestablished, or whether they moved. And I argue with people about that sometimes. And then allegedly, according to historical documents, they begin abandoning it in about 1545. But my research has shown it's probably later than that. Like, there are people, I'm sure, who were abandoning it at that point and moving to the modern city of San Salvador, that's now the capital of El Salvador, nearly 2 million people. But some people clearly seem to have continued living there.
Who are the residents? Who are these first settlers?
Right. So basically, this is going to sound like I'm not answering your question, but I am. Spaniards start settling, or they start conquering the Caribbean with Columbus, 1492 on. And very quickly, they start applying the tactics they were using to conquer parts of Muslim Spain, which concludes in 1492, actually. So literally, the last Muslim principality, Granada, falls in 1492. And then a few months later, around the same time, I have to look up, I think it's a few months later, Columbus does his thing. They start to apply these same techniques of the Reconquista and Repartimiento and Encomienda, well, Encomienda to begin with, not Repartimiento, and also just straight up slavery in the Caribbean. By the very early 1500s, this moves onto the mainland. By the early 1500s, you see it in Panama, and then, of course, very famously in 1519, Hernan Cortes, illegally, he was supposed to work for the Spanish government, and then he was recalled at the last minute. So he literally like snuck out of Cuba and goes to go after this Aztec empire he's heard of this, these Mexica, these Mexicans that he's heard of, who are supposedly wealthy, and they are. Fighting ensues, and a lot of that fighting is done with enemies of the center of the Aztec Empire, of Tenochtitlan and its allies that are the Triple Alliance, people that had been tributaries or had been like longtime enemies, after some initial fighting with these alien invaders, then joined them because they're like, well, we really dislike the people in Tenochtitlan. Let's work with these guys and then maybe we can deal with them later. And it doesn't turn out that way because they can't foresee the horrible disease load that's about to happen. They don't see these epidemics coming up, because nobody did. I say that because a lot of these guys actually end up being the settlers. So this gets really complicated in Guatemala. And Guatemala today is, you know, a very specific country, but the whole larger area of like El Salvador, parts of Honduras and Guatemala and Chiapas were all sort of Guatemala. And the borders changed in Spanish sort of organization, but that was all kind of one province that was largely run by, for a while, the Alvarado family. Pedro de Alvarado was the very bloodthirsty right-hand man to Hernan Cortes. So he leads an army of a few hundred, I want to say it's a couple hundred Spaniards, and thousands of Mexican warriors. Conquistadores Mexicanos is the name that eventually they get. Mexican conquerors, conquistadors. But they are not Spaniards. They are also called Indios Amigos, friendly Indians. They are also called, they have a couple of different names. So they all come on down. And by this point, disease is ravaging. In case our audience doesn't know, there is a massive inequality in the disease load. I mean, there are some diseases. There's one, and that gets complicated, that goes back to Africa and Eurasia. But there's a bunch of diseases that there is no immunity to that come across, most of which, though not all, have to do with Europeans and Africans and Asians having experience with herding cattle and goats and horses. So there's, you know, shared vectors and birds and so on. So a lot of diseases there's no immunity in the New World, causes massive death and devastation. It's very apocalyptic in some senses. So you have this Spanish expedition called an entrada come down, and after a number of battles, temporarily pacify, take over Guatemala and what's called Western El Salvador today, but would have been Cuscatlan and the Izalcos, these two Nahua-speaking, Nahuatl, the language of the Aztecs, speaking provinces. And then there's also Mayas in the region. Some other people too. Guatemala is primarily Maya, although there are some Pipils, these Nahua speakers as well there, like Cuscatlan and the Izalcos. So they show up and they build a town, San Salvador. And we always talk about it as a Spanish colonial town. In reality, the vast majority of the people that ever lived there would have been Mesoamericans. They would have been either these conquistadores mexicanos, and I think after the break we'll talk about the evidence for them, and they also would have been local Pipils that were forced or coerced, and sometimes not coerced, into the sort of growing colonial power structure, into the labor force, sometimes in slavery, all that ends in 1548, sometimes in conditions that are very similar to slavery, but that are not literally chattel slavery, like repartimiento and encomienda. And these are sort of like serfdom that's going on in the old world as well. There also would have been numerous, although we don't know the numbers, the historical data is not there at this point. It's there later in the 1500s. There would have been significant numbers of Africans in Central America as well that are brought by Spaniards. And so it's actually a far more diverse population. It's far more complicated because you've got Spaniards that are conquistadors and you've got Tlaxcalans that are also conquistadors. And they are not equal, but those Tlaxcalans are well high up in the pecking order, at least to start, than random Pipils that live in villages in Cuscatlan, that's now the province of Guatemala, and they in turn early on would have been higher in the pecking order than people that had literally been kidnapped on horseback from Nicaragua and sold into chattel slavery in the markets in San Salvador. So you start to have this colonial regime put together, and it gets more complicated as time goes. But I think after the break, what we're going to talk about is that while everybody talks about being very, very Spaniard, and I just said, well, a lot of people don't live there, aren't, there's also not just numbers, there's also cultural influence. And so I think we'll talk about how do we see that archaeologically, and I think the thing I'll leave our listeners for on the break, think about the kinds of stuff we talk about on this show, and, oh, Salutrians in North America, or, you know, Romans in, you know, Arizona, or Mayas in wherever, or Vikings everywhere. Think about what that would look like, because that's kind of what we're actually talking about, except we've actually got real evidence of people traveling thousands of miles and setting up shop.
Okay, well, let's go to break real quick, and when we come back, we will start talking about what we expect to see when we see travelers from far away settle here in the Americas.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to arcpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high-quality downloads of each show and a discount at our future online store, and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to arcpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's arcpodnet.com/members.
Everyone, and we are back, and we are going to talk about what we as archaeologists would expect to see in a contact site especially here in the Americas, where we have like the native peoples who are already here, and then they are contacted by a civilization that has come from across the ocean. In this case, we're talking about the Spaniards, and what we expect to see archaeologically in the dirt and in the record there to show us that has occurred.
Well, and I think that's important. I think equally, and I think frankly for today's shithole discussion, apparently, I think it's even more important is that this is also the archaeology at the beginning of the modern world. I mean, everything follows everything, everything follows everything. But again, as we sort of talked about in our first part, understanding the last 500 years, looking at these origins, that this is sort of the base of the modern world. The world really does change at this time. Like, this is an important thing. So, We were talking previously, and Ken had asked, you know, who would have lived here? And I gave a basic sort of capsule sketch of what we know from historical records and so on. So what's interesting, though, is you can see issues of power and race, ethnicity, identity, and gender all play out in who makes what, how things are represented in the archaeological record, and so on. So at this site, unlike some of the claims that we sometimes address on this show, it's not like you show up to San Salvador. It's like, oh, how do you know it's San Salvador? Well, there's a cryptic message that only I can see, and it looks like advertisements for real estate companies and Oreo cookies. It's not how it actually works here. That's not how the real world actually works.
But I like Oreo cookies.
I can't like Oreo cookies anymore, thanks to that hypothesis. But also, they're just, you know, I run these days. It's cold out and I'm running. I've become a crazy person, so no Oreos.
But they have Red Hot Oreos now.
I don't want to know what that is.
It's Red Hots in an Oreo, because you need that in your life.
Chili Oreos.
Okay, so did I mention the 21st century is a terrible place?
on multiple occasions.
Yeah, probably. I think I've done it every time we've recorded. So you don't find that. We do find architecture. And now in our case, there are other colonial sites that I have not worked on, but that my colleagues have worked on in that region that do have, for example, standing partial church architecture. And I have visited places with that. But this looks like a typical archaeological site. It's a field of grass and hills. You know, it's pretty typical. But when we do find architecture, there's stuff that's very, very obviously Spanish. Local materials, but made into foundations that are literally one vada, one sort of meter stick, one yardstick, 84 centimeters. Now, some of them vary, but clearly different than anything else that had been built in this region before and looking exactly like it does at other Spanish colonial sites. Lots of it. And laid out as an entire town of grid streets in the way that other Spanish colonial sites are built, with sort of more or less properly sized roads, equidistantly spaced into solar building lots. And we've done a lot of mapping. My colleague now works in the State Department, Connor Hamilton. This was a lot of his dissertation work, making a map. He did excavations and looked at architecture as well. And it's buried in literally millions of pieces of roof tile and floor tile, which, again, if you think of Latin American style architecture with sort of red barrel tiles, like traditional ceramic tiles on top of a roof so that the rain, you know, runs down, that's, you know, think of like a villa. I mean, the Romans did this sort of thing too, right? You think of a villa. Is there a kind of architectural name I'm sort of thinking of that people might know better, like the red roof tile, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know what you're talking. I don't know what it's called, but I know exactly what you mean.
Adobe? Is that Adobe? Yeah.
Well, adobe, these were puddled adobe buildings, and the two often go together because that's coming from Spanish colonial architecture. So these were not adobe.
And the terracotta roof? You're talking about terracotta roof?
It could be, yeah. I mean, it gets into like basically how they would be terracotta, because terracotta basically just means it's low-fired pottery, yeah.
Right.
But yeah, these would have been adobe, not usually blocks. It would have been puddled adobe built into, you know, you'd make a wooden wall and you'd puddle the adobe in and then let it, you know, take the framework off. Yeah, so yeah, think of California, you know, that kind
of. So like a daub house. Like, it's also how you do a daub house, where you put a frame up and then you put the mud in the cracks, like daubing.
No, this is more like adobe. When you're talking about wattle and daub, you're talking about like where you build a wooden framework and you kind of plaster around it. Those did exist at the site.
Right.
That's where the majority of people lived, but these are again more like think more Southwest, because of course a lot of Southwestern architecture, some of it is pre-Columbian, some of it's not, and there's some similarities there.
But you mainly like think stereotypical Southwest
to some degree, yeah. And again, California and or Peru or Mexico. I mean, these are all throughout Latin America. But we literally have millions of pieces of that, millions of pieces of these things that are unambiguous as to what they are, and they're locally made. So from the sort of the hyper diffusion perspective, you know, this stuff is very, very clear as to what it is. We also have not millions of pieces, but hundreds and hundreds of pieces of pottery straight from Spain. Like, it is obviously from there. Basically equivalent of like jugs and jars, a few nice dishes. We've got glass from Venice. And this is a relatively modest place. I mean, it's not a massive one. There is talk of trying to make it a World Heritage Site. El Salvador does have a World Heritage Site. It's got Hoya de Seren, the 7th century site that was destroyed by a volcano. But we've got, like, this is unequivocal. And this always drives me nuts when your people talk about, like, alleged contact sites in North America of, oh, and then, you know, some Phoenicians came here. How do you know? Well, there's scratches on this field rock. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? You know, where's their pottery? Where's their houses?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that we see again and again and again. People don't understand what an archaeological site looks like. And so they're looking for epigraphic evidence, like you say, scratch marks on a stone. Human beings cannot live in an area without producing a lot of material culture that's recognizably different from that of the local folks. But I wanted to ask you, Jeb, at this point, are the folks manufacturing ceramics back in Spain, are they putting maker's marks on the bottoms of these things?
It's not as common as it is later. Maker's marks, which are literally little marks, there are some. We've never found one. So you're probably... Well, Ken, you're actually pretty, I mean, have you dealt a lot? I guarantee you've dealt a lot with 18th and 19th century, especially 19th century.
Right, pottery. Exactly.
Have you dealt a lot with, like, I can't imagine any 16th century pottery that's not indigenous.
No, right. No. Here it's 18th and 19th century is the stuff that I personally have seen. There's 17th century stuff as well. And that stuff has maker's marks, and that stuff has design elements that are very clearly traceable to specific places in Europe.
Yes.
Or even specific potteries.
Yeah. It's not that dissimilar. Maker's marks do exist. They're not as I think as easy to use as once you get like the vast mass production you get in the 19th century. We have never found a maker's mark. They do exist. The pottery that we have not chemically tested it. If it's from specific places in Spain, I can tell you the olive jars, these botijas, these jugs for wine or olive oil or grains, which were all kind of like fancy foodstuffs. A lot of them were found around at our site, what we think is a tavern, which was where we also found the Venetian goblet. They're almost certainly from a number of cheap potteries along the Guadalquivir River in Sevilla. Like that is almost certain. You're like, you look at their paste, they're very, very distinctive. We have not, you know, done neutron activation analysis or some other thing to test that, but we're fairly certain about that. Some of the other pottery is also probably from Sevilla, though it might be from somewhere else in Spain. None of it appears to be from anywhere else in Europe, which is not surprising because the Spaniards kept a tight lid on sort of legal and illegal goods.
But essentially, you can trace the make of this pottery pretty succinctly.
By eye. I mean, if we really needed to, and we may do this in the future, like to answer future research questions, we could subject some of it to chemical testing and say this comes exactly from here. We haven't really had a need to do that, but it's not impossible that some of it might be some of the earliest Spanish style made in Mexico. It's probably not by looking at it, but that's something we've thought about testing and maybe something I do in the future. We have about 500 pieces of that. We've got 40,000 plus pieces of indigenous ware that's also colonial, and a bunch of it, and I know I've talked about this a little on the show before, has design elements from Europe, but it's locally made.
Can you quickly describe what indigenous ware is for people real quick, just so to refresh people's memory and, you know, to...
Well, I just mean the stuff that's not made by Europeans or Africans. I mean the stuff that's been made by Mesoamericans for thousands of years. It's not wheel thrown. It's not glazed. You don't have either of those in Mesoamerica or South America. You do have glazing on a few things in the American Southwest, but you don't have wheel throwing before 1492 or even really before like 1500 in the Americas. You have some things that are vaguely like wheels that are used for access, but you don't get the centrifugal force with the sort of like the flywheel approach if you think of wheel thrown pottery. You don't have that. So this stuff is locally produced, local materials. The designs on it are similar, though there are changes to the everyday designs you would have found in, say, 1450 in El Salvador or Guatemala in areas that are inhabited by Nahua speakers. Although it's not one-to-one with people speaking a language, there is some relationship. But some of the forms, for example, are the same forms that it would be on dinner plates in Italy or in Spain. Because things that are used for feasting, things that are used for dinner, things that are used for entertaining are often what we use to sort of create our identity and to negotiate identity. And we all do this. This is why you have fine china. This is why you have fancy glasses. You know, it's, you know, you don't have to drink wine out of a wine glass. You do, and it's not just because of how it tastes, because it's a cultural thing. It's the same sort of thing. And that does go both ways. When Europeans become obsessed with chocolate in the 16th century, when they discover it, and by discover it, I mean they take it from people making it, and they never heard of it in Mesoamerica, it comes over in pots that look a lot like Aztec chocolate pots, like the early European chocolate pots. And that part of that's because it's how you drink it, but part of it's also probably borrowed.
It's kind of interesting, though, because what you're talking about is early branding, even if it's not like, you know, Cadbury brand. It's people expect the chocolate to come in certain kinds of pots. And I bet if it came over in a pot that wasn't at least similar, it would probably be very untrusted chocolate.
Well, it's coming over in pots that are new. I don't think they would have known it. I think it's literally just somebody brought it back and they're like, there's actually literature on how people adopt things. I mean, this is some of the stuff that sends up what I'm talking about is, again, a contact site. I've had to do a lot of research into how do people adopt things. And if something comes in a package that's very much what they're already used to, it might actually be in some ways almost counterproductive. Like there's a certain aspect of if there's a really foreign thing, the fact that it comes in a foreign box sometimes is actually going to be part of the appeal.
Right, exactly.
Whereas
that makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Yeah, if you're already doing a thing, well, why do you need this foreign thing? And so there's a lot of research that shows, oh, you don't just simply take this thing. Now, some things you do. The one that everybody always talks about in the Americas is the two technologies that get very quickly adopted by non-Europeans in the Americas are the machete and pigs. Those are the two things that very quickly you find all over the place.
With the pigs, it's, you know, they're just that easy to get places, you know.
Well, you can kind of just leave them to do
their
thing.
Yeah, exactly. They just kind of do their thing and then you go eat them.
Yeah. And machetes, there's a lot of debate about that because there are a number of archaeologists that and others who have suggested that the myth of the steel machete, like immediately replacing stone tools, may be overblown. I will say by 1600, there's not a lot of people. It's not none, but not a lot of people using stone axes for foresting and cutting. There's still some in, say, Mesoamerica, but the machete is fairly popular. Like, it does actually get adopted pretty quick.
But that's another one of those things where...
Dandy,
I was going to say that the machete was just kind of a very versatile and sturdy tool.
Yeah.
Here in New England, what's really interesting is that the natives begin trading with European settlers for copper and brass pots, which the natives don't need. They don't want those. What they're then doing is repurposing that metal by cutting them into arrow shapes and then hafting them on and shooting back. It's this wonderful synergy here. They're smart enough to know we don't need those pots, but we can use that metal to make weapons to then shoot at the Europeans.
Nice.
Well, some of its weapons, the far more interesting one, and I think it actually may have been the more common use. We have a chapter in my Archaeology Hybrid Material Culture volume, and she's written more about this more broadly in her own work. Kathy Earhart has written how, so Copper, unlike what some basic cable television shows might tell you, Copper was used heavily by pre-1492 indigenous Americans. It wasn't stolen by Minoans for the super secret Templar Oreo network.
I was going to say, how could they possibly have done that, Jeb? We all know the aliens came and took all the copper.
So copper, first of all, you have to understand, bronze is a thing in South America by 1500.
Right.
And the Inca had bronze. Done. Bronze was not as big a thing in Mesoamerica. Metallurgy was not as big a thing. I mean, they did have gold and whatnot, but South America was really the heart of it. But there still was interest in copper, and there was also very much interest in copper in North America. And while it was used, like Ken said, for arrowheads during the colonial period, actually its primary sort of... And Ken, I know you you can chime in on this probably better than I can, but Kathy Earhart heavily talks about how copper had spiritual value. It was shiny. It was considered to be sort of part of the other world in many societies. It's sort of, you know, since a lot of other world stuff in North America has to do with the underworld being underwater, which is also Mesoamerican. It's tied into that. And so these buckets, in essence, became a new source of really nice copper, and it got chopped up and used and also traded to the West. Since there were still independent, unlike the sort of situation in most of Mesoamerica, although there were some independent groups like the Itza after 1550. But it gets chopped up and used also for that.
Often see these rolls, sheets of copper in burials, and they're not, it's not for any specific utilitarian aim there. They're simply rolling out these sheets of copper. They're not, this is not copper ore. There's no smelting. This is native raw copper that they are rolling out, flattening out, and then just including in burials. So that may be what we're talking about in that case, right?
Yes. Yeah. And so the thing again, to sort of, since we're about to come up on another break, I just would love to make this point about a lot of the hyperdiffusion stuff we often talk about on this show, which gets into colonialism and race. Most of these claims fall into two categories. One, oh, look, that's Phoenician writing and totally not scratches or totally not, you know, Hebrew made in a 19th century mechanical font in Ohio or whatever. The other thing is, oh, look, they're depicting white men. They're depicting bearded white men because that's super important. Well, actually, when you do have independent people on the running these outsiders, what they do? They picked them clean of the awesome stuff and repurposed it. You know, the fact that the evidence of contact with Europeans in, say, Connecticut and Massachusetts is not some big statue of some white dude, but is instead, they have nice copper. Take it. And sometimes shoot it at them, and otherwise let's use it. And use it in ways we want to use it. And so even if you're adopting foreign things, you're doing it for your own reasons. And we find that constantly in the archaeological record. It's only in the sort of colonialist fantasies kind of following after H. Rider Haggard and whatnot, where it's like, oh, look, they made a racially significant in the 19th and 20th century statue to us. No.
Right.
That's bullshit.
Which, of course, also comes back to that whole reinterpreting what you want to see in the record where it's not present argument. But let us go to break, and when we come back, I think we still have a couple things we want to talk about as far as colonialism and what we're expecting to see when we see contact. So,
interested in archaeology? Want to hear from experts in the field about the latest discoveries and interpretations? Check out The Archaeology Show every other Saturday and let hosts Chris Webster and April Camp Whitaker take you deeper into the story. Check out The Archaeology Show at www.archpodnet.com/archaeology and subscribe, rate, and comment on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and the Google Music Store. That's www.archpodnet.com/archaeology. Now back to the show.
And we are back. And Jeb, you wanted to wrap up this discussion that we're having about colonialism and contact.
Well, about El Salvador specifically. I mean, I wrote an 803-page book, which even if you format it down to a normal book, like a dissertation.
Did you want to read that to us?
Exactly. So even then, I mean, I have a lot I could say on this. But, you know, what I was sort of wanting to talk about was, A, our normal issues. How do we know what we know? How... this is what an actual contact site looks like and isn't. But also the thing I kept, I hope, hitting was power and ethnicity and race and gender. And these were contested things. Like, these were not just, oh, now these people are conquered. Now it's like, no, there was a lot of resistance. There was one, there was literal armed resistance. I did mention that the site was abandoned. When I mean abandoned, the first time, because it was burnt to the ground. So first of all, there's that.
I don't know if that counts as abandoned. I feel like that's more of a forced out kind of thing.
If your house is on fire, people are shooting you, I think abandoning ship is abandoned works.
That's fair, but it's not like, you know, they were just like, eh, let's pack up and move. It was kind of like motivated.
Yeah. Well, they did do that eventually. And then, you know, speaking of Spanish colonial stuff, this is not my work, but many people often talk about the first American Revolution being in the American Southwest. Is it 1680 with the Pueblo Revolt?
Yeah, the Pueblo Revolt, I think, is 1680, right?
Yeah, and so for about like 10, 12 years, there was a successful revolt that threw the Spaniards and their allies out of the American Southwest. And there's some really cool archaeology. Again, there's a chapter on this in my Archaeology, Hypermaterial Culture, but by Matt Liebman. But I just wanted to get out of the El Salvador stuff, but just... Again, we were sort of inspired to talk about these issues by the bullshit that's coming from the White House on this. And that was partly inspired by the TPP. We talked about this, but the intended revocation of basically help for people that fled devastating earthquakes in El Salvador. But of course, El Salvador has had a longer history of problems recently, including its most biggest one being a war that was heavily funded and supported by the United States in the 1980s, a massive, devastating civil war. And as someone who goes and has lived in El Salvador on and off for years, I can tell you, you know, hell, people talk about we're still fighting the American Civil War here, which I think is an accurate statement. And that's 150 years ago. This is 15 or 25 years ago now. And 100,000 people in a country of 7 million people died during that war. And it was part of the larger Cold War, but it was a major issue in American politics. At one point, it got hot enough that there was concern that America was going to literally have ground troops. Like I remember in the 1980s, that was a serious concern. And so the effects of that, which fit into a larger colonial world, are still there. So when people talk about, oh, these people and that, people's like, do you, and I just want to say this, I've traveled in a number of different countries. I'm not a super world traveler. There are a hell of a lot of El Salvadorans who are huge fans of the United States and have served in its military, have done all these things. So I don't want to get into that further, but that bothered me so much. And I've spent so much of my, you know, much of my intellectual capital has been built by working with archaeologists in El Salvador and the government in El Salvador and researchers there, as well as other people there. And so mentioning the TPP and all that, we also want to talk a bit about immigration and sort of how archaeology can speak to kind of immigration and its importance. And Ken, you had some things you want to talk about that.
Well, yeah. And I know that we have mentioned the whole shithole thing. And I wasn't there. I don't know if Donald Trump said that or not. Although you will notice that on most of the cable news channels, we've got all these kind of very straight reporters who have used the word shithole on air more times than you can possibly count.
They're
so I guess if the president says it and you're quoting him, it's okay.
They're stealing our profanity bit.
I know.
Now we got nothing.
I think they're just happy they get to say the word shit. That. I mean, they're like 5-year-olds. They're like, ooh, I get to swear. Dee.
That actually was, you know, when Lenny Bruce, the great comedian, was arrested for saying all manner of things on stage. So, you know, all those words that people yell at us for using, when he used on stage, he ended up getting arrested. And I guess he actually got arrested for saying the word cocksucker. But at the trial, they had to, the police who witnessed this, the attorneys, the judge, everybody had to say that word to put it on the trial record. So Lenny Bruce was very amused by this, that the word he was arrested for saying was said multiple times during the trial. He said, what? He said, cocksucker? Read that back to me. What was it that he said? So it's kind of hilarious. But anyway, I don't care if he said
so
that or
many
not.
Comments.
Yeah, I don't care if he said that or not. You will remember that several months ago, Trump announced his preferred immigration policy, in which he was going to cut immigration by 50% and give priority to people who wanted to come to this country, who already spoke English, and who had this kinds of skills we need in America. Now, if you're a conservative, I would imagine you would respond to that by saying that's antithetical to the whole concept of American exceptionalism, where, you know, we want you're tired and you're hungry. Those are the people who are going to make America great, not people who are already fat and happy. But that's another issue.
Ken, I'm just going to say this right now. Just imagine I'm going to say this at least 50 times before the show's over. Yeah, about that. So I'm sorry, just assume I'm saying it constantly, okay? Just continue.
I will hear that in the back of my head throughout. Now, here's the deal. We've talked a bunch about national monuments on this podcast. And especially recently, we've talked about Bears Ears and the significance, the importance of preserving these wonderful places for all Americans to appreciate. There are 129 national monuments. 23 of them have as a major focus Native American culture history. Most of the others focus on beautiful landscapes, amazing geology. But there are a handful of national monuments that focus on immigration and the lives of immigrants to America. And now, since Ben Carson is allowed to call African captives slaves, African slaves, he's allowed to call them immigrants, so will I. Here in southern Manhattan, in New York, is the African Burial Ground. This was excavated in the 1990s to the early 2000s. They found 400 burials. Archaeologists, forensic anthropologists, biological anthropologists excavated 400 burials. These are all African captives, all slaves, first to the Dutch and then to the English. And the evidence of repetitive stress injury, of violence visited upon these people, there are individuals who died by being shot, individuals who died through their bodies being mangled. We know this. We suspected this, of course. We know this through the archaeology. So we have national monuments that don't necessarily – are not all necessarily about celebrating the wonderful American story, but in our recognizing that we shouldn't flinch from these. These are aspects of our history that we need to confront and need to address, and that's a good thing. The Manzanar National Monument in California, that is one of the internment camps. I sometimes call them concentration camps and people yell at me, but I think that's an accurate term as well, where over 100,000 Japanese Americans, these are American citizens who were deprived of their freedom and were put in effectively prison simply because they were of Japanese ancestry. You'll notice there were not any internment camps for German Americans.
Right.
It was perfectly okay if you were of German descent. Nobody thought, oh, they're going to be siding with Hitler. But if you were Japanese, the assumption was your first commitment was going to be to the emperor or to Japan. Now, that is a national monument.
Are you saying we shouldn't have allowed somebody named Eisenhower to be in the army? Is that what you're saying?
How can you trust somebody with that last name? Obviously. Now, the Manzanar camp is a national monument. You can visit that place. And there is community archaeology is conducted at Manzanar. They're trying to reconstruct some of the structures that were there on the camp. A lot of these things were destroyed at the end of the war because nobody wanted to this was literally, let's sweep this under the rug, or metaphorically, let's sweep it under the rug. But as a national monument, we can't do that. And folks who were actually in the camps, or especially as children, it's George Takei, the guy who plays Sulu in Star Trek. His childhood took place in I believe it's the Manzanar camp. He was in an internment camp again, Japanese American citizens. And so through doing historical research, documentary research, oral histories, and archaeology, we are not celebrating what happened at Manzanar, but at least making sure that we don't forget. That's a part of the American story. We did that to people.
Yeah, I read a master's thesis on, I don't know if it was Manzanar, but one of the internment camps, because it was some of the same issues I was dealing with my Spanish colonial stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And
well, it goes back to what I've said a few times about history isn't always nice, and we need to remember the not nice parts so that we don't do that again.
Right, exactly. These are things that a mature culture, a culture that has a little bit of self-confidence, is not afraid
yeah, about that.
Is not afraid to confront some of the bad things that they have done in the past. When my younger son is now 24, when he was 10, so say when he was 14, yeah, about fifth grade, so 10 years old, I was roped into acting as a chaperone for a class trip to the Statue of Liberty Ellis Island National Monument. And it was amazing. So the Ellis Island, this is the port of entry for, I think it's 12 million, mostly Europeans, 1892 to 1954. And that national monument doesn't shy away from looking at some of the bad stuff that happened to immigrants. So that, yes, people had to walk through a phalanx of medical professionals who decided whether or not those people were healthy enough to become Americans. And in some cases, decisions were made about mental competence simply on the basis of the fact that people couldn't follow simple directions because they did not speak English.
Or if they just didn't like them.
Exactly. And here's the thing that I thought of, looking, if Trump's called the places shitholes or whatever the hell he called them, it's important for people listening to this broadcast to understand that for many of you, the place where your ancestors came from, at one time, those were considered shitholes and we should keep you people out. If you are an Italian American, understand that when your ancestors came to America in the 19th century, there were people here who said, Italy, what a shithole. We don't want people from there. If you are an Irish American, it is exactly the same thing. That if you're, when your ancestors came here, what was it, during and after the potato famine, the belief was, my God, do we want Irish people here? The Ireland is a shithole. If you are a Polish American, you know it's true that when your ancestors came here in the 19th century, that there were people here in America who said, we should keep those people out. They are going to bring America down.
I don't think people understand that if they have that kind of heritage, which most of us do.
For sure.
If you look back on the census records, even as far back as the 1920s, your ancestors could possibly have been listed as quote unquote black, even though they were not what we would consider that today, simply because they were considered to be part of a lesser race. So exactly. You've got a lot of people. Yeah, you've got a lot of people who are culture, who would consider themselves white today, who technically have black ancestry because the census decided to record your immigrant grandparents, great-great-grandparents, or however far many greats, as a black person because they were considered to be less.
And this gets into a lot of the complicated issues of race and power and colonialism that Ken, for example, you all did the episode, you did the episode on the Lighthouse site.
Right, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
They dealt very much with these issues. So go back into our archives. I forget which one. It's probably around number 15 or so. I'd be my
guess. That was such a good episode, too. We got so much good mail for that one. That was a good, good one.
Here's the deal. For anybody who's going to say, well, you guys are getting political, I want to say something now that's not political. It's entirely personal. And this, it's the thing that when I heard Trump talk about, well, what we want, I mean, most recently, I guess he said we need more people from Norway and fewer people from shithole countries. But No.
He said we needed people from Norway, M-A-Y, Norway.
Oh, is that right? Well, I don't think he could find Norway on a map personally. But here's where I'm going. Here's where I'm going with this. I got really very, very upset. I got really pissed off. I mean, he always pisses me off, but I got really pissed off because this is very personal. Eight out of eight of my great-grandparents were born in Eastern Europe. They came to America. They escaped the shtetls, the Jewish ghettos of Poland and Austria and Germany and Russia in the latter part of the 19th century because they saw the handwriting on the wall, or maybe it was just they were tired of being oppressed and poor. They came to America. Eight out of eight, none of them spoke English. None of them had any particular skills. They were peasants. Had Trump's edict been in place then, those people would not have made it to America. Their children, my grandparents, would have been born in Eastern Europe. My parents would have been born in Eastern Europe. They all would have been killed in the Holocaust. I would not exist. I take that really fucking personally. And one more thing. When my great-grandparents got here, they came here with nothing. They were not educated. They didn't speak English. Looking at my father's line, my father's father, my grandfather Max, born in America in 1898, he became a stevedore. He was a working-class guy, made a life for his family, not very well educated. One more generation from we're talking about my father now, two generations removed from those poor peasants who came to America in the 1800s. My father has a PhD from Berkeley. Two generations of immigrants. We start off poor and don't speak English, no money at all. And two generations later, you've got somebody at one of the most prestigious schools in the world getting his PhD. So anybody, you know, this pisses me off. This notion that, oh, if people come here poor and they don't speak English, they're going to be a drag on the economy. We don't want those people here. That's not what the science says of the Statue of Liberty, exactly. Guys.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, I thought you said we were about to say the science. You don't have to be an anthropologist or sociologist. An economist will tell you that immigrants are usually amongst your most gainfully employed, most hardworking.
Yeah, I was just getting ready to say that.
And the reason I want to bring this up, and I want to get back into archaeology in a sense, not like old-timey, but one of the things about historical archaeology is that you're like, well, why do you need archaeology? You got historical records. Because historical records are very much part of a colonial world. They are part of a system of power. You know, you have people with power, their lives get recorded, except for the parts they don't want you to record. Whereas those without power, often their lives are not recorded in the same way. And so historical archaeology has largely taken on, like Ken's lighthouse work, like my work in El Salvador. And I know, Sarah, you've done numerous different both historical and prehistoric pre-European sites as well. This is often a large amount of how we can learn about this past. And I'd like to bring in one very fascinating and also depressing and terrifying but important project that I don't know this research, although maybe we should reach out and see if we can get them on here. But there's always this idea that, like, oh, immigrants today, they're something different than before. You know, Ken was saying everybody's got, you know, unless you're indigenous, you got an immigrant, or, you know, not getting back to Ben Carson, because good God. But most people who identify as white have immigrant, everybody identifies as white as an immigrant in their background in the United States. But there's always this idea, oh, they were different before. Well, can you mention if Trump's edicts were in? Well, but as you know, there were attempts at keeping people out. I mean, for decades, it was illegal to immigrate legally to the United States if you were Chinese. Like, there were laws that made that illegal.
Pretty much every ethnic group that is established in America now has at some point been either barred or very much told no to coming to America at some point.
Right.
But like you were saying, the Irish, the Polish, there was a point where the Germans were not welcome there because my family had a hard time getting over here when that happened.
No, the consequence of that is that there's a lot of people, I've heard people say, like, oh, but they don't want to take their turn today and they don't want to do this. It's like, that's a lie or ignorance. There were people that were breaking the law when there were these quota laws and bans in the past. And there were tons of people who did not learn the language but came here and they worked it out anyway. This idea that there's something different about people from, say, El Salvador is just historically not accurate. And this brings me to a very fast, again, both fascinating, depressing, and important project. Do y'all know what the MacArthur Genius Awards are, the genius grants?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, where the MacArthur Foundation gives out significant money to work that they think is important of all kinds. And there's usually an archaeologist. In the past, there's been several Maya epigraphers and archaeologists. This time, Jason De Leon, an archaeologist who's put together this project of using GIS and archaeology to document the archaeology of the northern border of Mexico and the southern border of the United States, which is literally, as some have called it, a land of open graves, rather than, say, a land of enchantment. But a land of open graves, because you can find the archaeology of people trying to cross to the north and people being dry gulched and left to dead with no water by coyotes. And all, I mean, these are people that are giving thousands of dollars and putting themselves into debt, often sometimes to criminals, to criminal organizations of traffickers, which then has horrible consequences. And many are dying because they're lazy. Really? Is that how that works? There, you know, how many of people complaining about this are going to be trekking through a desert anytime soon? I'm just saying, you know, not driving from McDonald's to McDonald's.
Right. Yes.
I think this is the important part that archaeology has to play, because something that we've kind of hinted at, and I don't think we've come out and directly said, but archaeology, especially historical archaeology, is inherently political. It's very difficult to separate politics from archaeology, and the more recent your archaeology, the harder it is. Like with what's going on, this land of open graves. I mean, that's a horrifying name, but it's descriptive, and that's the point. There is no way to do that archaeology and not somehow be in the political sphere, because that archaeology exists because of the political sphere.
Well, not only that, I mean, one of the complaints that sometimes leveled as archaeology is, you know, well, what are you doing there? You're just looking through all those old potsherds and bones. For what purpose? Well, this has a purpose. This is actually helping answer questions that are important for right now.
Right. And it's archaeology is itself the study of human life through material culture and through the remains of material culture. And I mean, I can't imagine something that's more... That studies human life more than discovering how people get to the places they want to go. And people are still moving around today, and whether you want them here or not, they're going to continue to keep coming. So,
well, and not only that, as I was talking about with the Salvadoran Civil War, this is all part of a larger system. It's not like these are things that are divorced from each other, you know?
Yes, exactly.
Look, we had a bunch of wars as part of the Cold War in a region, and then suddenly people want to leave that region. What possible relationship could there be between these two events?
And it's also something that you see in the archaeological record time and time again. You see upheaval or the loss of resources in an area, and those people will move to another area. Sometimes they move into an area where there's already people, and when that happens, two things happen. They either assimilate or there's conflict. This is the exact same thing we're seeing today, and we see it because we see the archaeology. And we can compare these things because we have the archaeology to do it.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the major contributions of historical archaeology is the recognition that the historical record is far from objective. What was it? Winston Churchill who said, "History will be kind to me, for I intend to write it." You know, very often history is written by the victors, by and very often the only people who are literate are the folks who are the superordinate group. I love one of my favorite Ambrose Bierce quotes in from his Devil's Dictionary is his definition of history, which is history is an account mostly false of events mostly unimportant, which are brought about by rulers mostly knaves and soldiers mostly fools. And I think in a lot of ways, the archaeological record is a way of addressing that. Look, the archaeological record is democratic. The archaeological record doesn't necessarily have an agenda. And oftentimes history does.
Right. And archaeology is one of the few ways that disenfranchised people or unrepresented people can be heard and can be recognized, because we're not looking at... I mean, in historical archaeology, we do look at records, but it's not uncommon for a record to not match the archaeology left in the ground. And that's where the archaeologists come in, because it's to discern between the history that we're supposed to see and the history as it really
is. Yeah. But another really interesting example there is that in the South, before the Civil War, it was actually illegal in many of the states to teach slaves to read and write. Well, there was a reason for that. They didn't want captives. They didn't want slaves telling their side of the story. And so in those cases, archaeology, if you can read, you can read what the plantation owners said about the system of slavery. But is that going to be objective, do you think? Really? So archaeology,
or in that case, like a good detective, you can dig up the evidence.
Right. And archaeology allows for that. And that's why one of the reasons that I get really upset when researchers don't release their findings as fast as they could or probably should. I mean, I think 2 years is generous. Granted, I have not been in this position yet, but I will be soon. And my goal is to get my research out there as fast as I can, because there's a lot of information that is lost or is buried, and not intentionally so, but because we take too long to communicate. And then we get things like uninformed people saying things that they shouldn't say in public out loud, and they end up being our leaders. Final thoughts, Jeb?
I think I've had thoughts today.
I think I've had my thoughts. Ken, you want to add anything else?
No, I mean, I think that when we started today, there were different issues that seemed kind of only vaguely connected, but I think in the end here, we brought it all together. So hopefully the audience will come through to the audience.
Yeah. And if people have questions or comments about anything we've talked about today, you are welcome to reach out to us at archiefantasies@gmail.com or go to the website or our podcast website and contact us through that. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, guys, for recording.
Thank you. Human
evolution makes us smile. Thanks for listening to the Archaeological Fantasies podcast. You can find links to the items mentioned on the show at our website at www.archpodnet.com/archaeofantasies. Like and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Be sure to share this episode with your friends on social media. Follow Sarah's Archie Fantasies blog at www.archiefantasies.com. You'll also find the show on Tumblr, Twitter, and Facebook, also at Archie Fantasies. Music was provided by Archeosoup at Archeosoup Productions. Thanks again for listening.
We don't do dinosaurs!
This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
See? Are you happy? Do you get it now? Do you get it?